Old Testament Survey, lecture number 25. We're doing study pack 13a today. For this study pack, you'll need to memorize Daniel chapter 12, verses 2 and 3. In Daniel's day, the city of Babylon was the premier city of the world, ruling the most powerful empire that had existed up until that time. This empire lasted for 70 years, with Daniel being there from the beginning of it, the empire, to its fall. Daniel was taken captive in 605 B.C. by Nebuchadnezzar, ministered in Babylon from the first year of King Nebuchadnezzar through the reigns of the succeeding five kings, then passed the fall of Babylon into the Persian Empire. Daniel continued on through the reign of Darius unto the third year of Cyrus, the king of Persia. And so from 605 B.C. until 534 B.C., 2 years after the return of the Jews from captivity, God had Daniel and placed Daniel as a witness in the palace of the empires that ruled the world. Although we include Daniel among the prophets in our Bibles, our English Bibles, in the Hebrew Scriptures, Daniel is found in a group of books called the Writings. Daniel was not looked upon by his contemporaries as being a prophet. He was viewed as a governmental leader. And that's why his writings have been placed where they are in the Hebrew Scriptures. His writings were included in the group that contains Psalms, Proverbs, Job, Song of Solomon, Ruth, Lamentations, Ecclesiastes, Esther, Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, and 1st and 2nd Chronicles. And all of these lumped together counted as one book. Or actually, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, rather, counted as one book. Daniel's not included among the books of the prophets because, again, he's not viewed as a prophet to Israel during his day. Although Daniel never publicly addressed the nation of Israel with a prophetic message, Jesus referred to Daniel as being a prophet in the New Testament. In Matthew chapter 25, verse 15, "When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand." And so very clear that Jesus Christ considered Daniel to be a prophet. Daniel, which means God is my judge, was a prince of the royal house of David. He was one of those that was carried away again captive into Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar in the very first captivity. At that time, Jeremiah had already been prophesying for 23 years. So you start putting some of these things into context. Daniel would have been familiar with Jeremiah and with the prophecies of Jeremiah from his years as a young man, even in Jerusalem. This was 9 years before Ezekiel was carried away captive. That was when Daniel was carried. 9 years before Ezekiel was carried captive, and 12 years before Ezekiel began to prophesy. Because Daniel lived through the entire Babylonian captivity and into the time of the Persian Empire as well, Daniel had to have been very young when he was carried into captivity. Daniel probably would have been around 90 years old when Zerubbabel led the first expedition back to Jerusalem. People say, well, why didn't Daniel go back? Well, a 90-year-old guy couldn't handle that trip, believe me. He exercised the prophetic office longer than either Jeremiah or Ezekiel. His 70 years of ministry exceeded the ministry of any other Old Testament prophet by far. We're going to look now at Daniel the man. Daniel was of royal blood. And according to the historian Josephus, Daniel was a relative of King Zedekiah, which of course would have made it easier for Daniel to be able to have access to the palace. Daniel was chosen with three other young Hebrews. We commonly know them as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And if you want to know how to spell those names, turn to Daniel chapter 1. Or the score key. But Daniel was chosen with three other young Hebrews, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, to be trained for the king's service. It's very possible that Nebuchadnezzar took such young men to Babylon to train them for administrative duties in relationship to the responsibilities dealing with their country. Just in case he needed to send them back to Judah, he would have somebody that would be trained, somebody that would know his system, know his way of doing things. These handsome, brilliant young men who were under the care of God were trained by God to bear witness to his name in the heathen court that then ruled the world. It had to be a kind of a traumatic thing. These were young guys removed from their home. At the very beginning of Daniel's ministry, you find Daniel being the guy that's saying, hey guys, you know what? We need to stand up for what's right here. We're not going to eat the king's food. Daniel was very gracious about it, but Daniel stood up from the very beginning. In his older years, you have to stop and think about Daniel in the lion's den. Daniel was a very old man by that time because he had lived through the 70-year captivity already. And Daniel didn't flinch when he grew old either from doing what God wanted. And so he had a long life, a life of obedience to God. Through his abstinence from partaking in the king's dainties, through his diligence, his brilliance, because he was a brilliant man, and his reliance upon God, you know, reliance upon God does make you brighter. He gained favor and advancement from the king's chief eunuch. Somewhere, Daniel had learned, perhaps at his mother's knee, that the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord, and the Lord turneth it as the rivers of water. He turneth it whithersoever he will. I think back the first year that I was lobbying, had a piece of legislation that was really adverse to the churches. And that piece of legislation, I was the only guy opposing it. And it looked like a totally uphill battle all the way to be able to stop the legislation. In the end, it originally passed the Senate with 52 out of 59 votes. It went to the House. They amended it. It passed with 82 votes. Went back to the Senate. The Senate sponsor didn't agree with the House amendment, so it was going to go to conference committee. In the end, the guy who helped write the bill spoke against the bill on the floor and helped kill it. He is a liberal Jewish man who he and I have never agreed on another bill since then. But it really is true. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord as the rivers of water. He turneth it whithersoever he will. We had another bill back in, I think it was 94. And that piece of legislation looked like we had it stopped. And the Speaker of the House said, let the bill out of the Rules Committee. Passed through the House, passed through the Senate. It went to the governor's office. The governor did an amendatory veto on it. During the veto session, the Speaker of the House met with me the last night of legislative session and agreed not to bring the bill to the floor for a vote the next day. And it killed it. Now, God took the guy who said, let that bill out. And in the end, he was the guy who said, we're killing that bill. God turns the heart to the king whithersoever he wills. And so don't look at things and say it's an absolutely hopeless situation because God is there. And God intervenes in the affairs of men. Daniel knew that his first priority was to please God, trusting God for the results of his willingness to stand. Now you have to understand, Daniel didn't go to the king's eunuch and say, listen, we're Jewish, we're not supposed to be eating this garbage you guys are serving us. Daniel was very gracious in his approach to the king's eunuch. He was not being obnoxious, but coming to the prince of the eunuchs with a very reasonable approach. He said, look, let's just try this, and you can look at everybody else in comparison to us and see what it's going to be like. The guy was skeptical, but the guy said, well, okay, it can't hurt to give it a try. Now, afterwards, probably everybody else hated Daniel's guts because they had to stop eating the king's dainties and go on the same diet as Daniel and his friends. But Daniel did what was right and stood for what was right. King Nebuchadnezzar probably didn't care one way or the other what Daniel had to eat or that Daniel wanted to please God above all. That wasn't his concern. Daniel trusted that God would be able to incline the heart of the king favorably toward him. When I ask people to pray for me when I go to other churches, I ask them, first of all, to pray that I'd keep my eyes on the Lord, and secondly, I ask that God would give me favor in the eyes of the legislators. Favor in the eyes of the legislators by God goes a long, long ways. And God grants it. And that's the wonderful thing. We can trust God. And this trust of God resulted in Daniel as serving as the prime minister under four dynasties of the world's greatest powers. Daniel was unswerving in his religious convictions. Yet he was so loyal to his king that he was entrusted with the affairs of the kingdom. Ezekiel mentions Daniel, not as a writer, not as a prophet, but as a righteous and wise man. By the time Ezekiel began to minister, if you remember, that was 12 years after Daniel was taken into captivity that Ezekiel began to minister, Daniel had already made a name for himself as being righteous. And of course, Ezekiel saw that and mentioned Daniel in the same sentence with Noah and Job. Ezekiel declares of Daniel, "There is no secret that they can hide from thee," suggesting that Daniel's explanation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream was well known to Ezekiel. And I'm sure it was well known to the Jewish people. Obviously, Daniel chronicled and wrote down the things that happened when he was ministering. Although Daniel's name is not mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11, which talks about the heroes of faith, his deeds are recorded. In verse 33 of Hebrews 11, who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouth of lions. We don't find anybody else really in the Old Testament that did that. Daniel certainly did. Daniel's piety, his humility, his faithfulness, his dependence upon God are referred to in almost every chapter of the book of Daniel. Daniel was known as a great man of prayer, interceding for his people, asking God for forgiveness of his people, asking God for the restoration of his people. His prayer in Daniel chapter 9 for the children of Israel is one of the most touching prayers that you're going to find recorded in the Bible. Daniel walked with God in such a way that God allowed him to talk to the angels. The angel Gabriel addressed Daniel three times, calling him a man greatly beloved. That's quite a title, coming from one of God's angels. Daniel is one of the few people that we find in the Bible about whom there are no recorded faults. Daniel was much like the Apostle John. The Apostle John was also greatly beloved. Both Daniel and John were given a larger, much larger outlook on the future than any other prophet. Their visions of the glorified Christ in Daniel chapter 10, verses 5 through 10, and Revelation chapter 1, verses 12 through 18, are very similar to each other. And sometimes just take some time and sit down and do a comparison of the two. As we look at the book of language, the book of Daniel, the languages that are used in the book of Daniel are somewhat unusual because Daniel is written in two different languages. Daniel chapter 1, verses 1 through 2, verse 4a, and chapters 8 through 12 are written in Hebrew. This is the language of God's people. Daniel chapter 2, verse 4b, and through 7, verse 28 is written in Aramaic. Aramaic was the common dialect that was used during the prophet's day. Hebrew was the language of God's covenant people. Aramaic was the language of the Gentile world. The book of Daniel has two major emphases. The first major emphasis deals with God's program for the Gentile nations, which makes it fitting that Daniel would write this section in Aramaic. First major emphasis deals with God's program for the Gentile nations, which makes it fitting that Daniel would write this section in Aramaic. The second major emphasis is on the nation of Israel, and the influence and effect of the Gentiles on Israel. Therefore, it's fitting that Daniel writes this portion in Hebrew, the language of the Jews. We'll take a brief look now at Daniel's literary style. The prophecy of Daniel is the first great book of apocalyptic literature that's found in the Bible. Apocalyptic literature means it's an unveiling, a disclosing, or a revelation. This is the first great book of apocalyptic literature. In addition to Daniel, apocalyptic literature is found in Ezekiel chapter 37, verse 40 through 48, and Zechariah 1, verses 7 through 7, verse 8. Apocalyptic literature has several different characteristics. First of all, when you have apocalyptic literature, you have a person that has received God's truths and visions, who records what was seen. A person has received God's truth and visions and records what was seen. Secondly, you'll find that there's an extensive use of symbols or signs. There's an extensive use of symbols or signs. The third thing we see with apocalyptic literature is it normally gives revelation concerning God's program for the future of Israel. It normally gives revelation concerning God's program for the future of Israel. And finally, the fourth thing we see is that prose is usually employed in apocalyptic literature rather than the poetry that you find in most prophetic literature. Prose is normally employed rather than the poetry that was normal in most prophetic literature. In interpreting visions, symbols, and signs in apocalyptic literature, you need to examine the context or make a comparison with a parallel passage of Scripture, and you get God's interpretation of the visions and the symbols that are being used in that way. And so we find that apocalyptic literature requires a careful comparison of Scripture with Scripture to arrive at a correct understanding of the revelation that is being given. Understandably, the critics are not very pleased with the book of Daniel. According to the contents of the book of Daniel, it was written during the 6th century B.C. by Daniel, who lived during its events. Now, Christ attributed, if you remember when we look back at the passage where Jesus talked about Daniel the prophet, Christ attributed the authorship of the book to Daniel in Matthew chapter 24, verse 15. You find that Daniel had a lot of familiarity with the individuals that are spoken of in the book, along with the historical events and the customs that really necessitate a 6th century B.C. written date or date for the book being written. Manuscript fragments of the book of Daniel are found in Qumran. They were found in Qumran dating back to the 2nd century B.C. The fact that the book of Daniel was accepted by the Jews into the canon of Scripture also gives testimony to its authenticity. Critics reject an early date for the book of Daniel primarily because they reject the idea of predictive prophecy. The book discloses details of three of the major world empires before they happened. The details recorded in Daniel were fulfilled in the 4th to the 2nd century B.C. And so the skeptics insist that Daniel could not have foreknown such events. So he must have written about them after they took place, then wrote about them as prophecies to give credence to his writings. Their view denies the power of God to reveal what God has determined to reveal. There are some also that argue that there are Greek and Persian words used in Daniel that make it so Daniel must have been written much later than the 6th century B.C. However, archaeology has come to the rescue. Archaeology has revealed that there was extensive commerce between Greece and Babylon. And so it wasn't unusual that all these Greek words were going to be present. The Persian words that were used in the book were widely used in official or literary form throughout the Near East. There are other critics, of course, who go and say, well, it couldn't have been, the book of Daniel couldn't have been written by him because it refers to his death in Daniel chapter 1, verse 21. Notice it doesn't talk about his death there. It says in Daniel 1, verse 21, and Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus. It doesn't say Daniel died. It just says he continued on until then. In Daniel 10, verse 1, Daniel writes about a vision he received in the third year of Cyrus' reign. So it's obvious Daniel did not die in the first year of Cyrus' reign from the very context of the book itself. As a young Christian, I always struggled, and I struggled many times with what the higher critics had to say. And even as a pastor, when I'd read in many of the commentaries, I'd read the commentaries and the commentators would say, you know, well, this person in the back, you go back over here and this book could not possibly have been written here. And you find out what they really want to do is they want to attribute everything to natural causes. They want to eliminate the supernatural. I remember years ago picking up a book, I don't remember what the name it was something like the Miracles of the Bible and stuff like that. And so I picked up this book and I thought, well, this will be an interesting book. Well, it was a book that was written by a humanist who was taking all the different things in the Bible and trying to give logical explanations for why things happened the way they did and trying to show how people exaggerated what really happened. And what it was really done in doing, it was a book that was written to undermine people's faith. And that's what you find that the higher critics' goal is anyway. The higher critics, you have to remember, are tools. And I believe that they're tools that are being used by the devil. Because the devil's very first thing that he did was raise the question in Eve's mind, did God really say this? And that's exactly what the higher critics are doing. Did God really say this? They're just being a little more sneaky about it. And they're saying, well, you know, this didn't really happen. This wasn't really predicted. This wasn't really prophesied. There are things that we're going to find as we go through the book of Daniel, though, that make it so that the higher critics cannot dispute what is written there. As we look at it historically, Daniel bridges the gap between Israel's historical books and the New Testament. It records historical events during the Babylonian captivity that are found no other place in Scripture except for some small bits of information in the book of Ezekiel, who was also a prophet in exile. Daniel outlines the history of the times of the Gentiles. He outlines the history of the times of the Gentiles, describing the past and future empires that occupy Palestine and rule over Israel until Messiah returns. The prophecies in the book of Daniel lay the eschatological foundation for God's program for the Gentiles. They lay the eschatological foundation for God's program for the Gentiles, for the land of Palestine, and for the people of Israel. The emphasis on the Gentile nations is paralleled as well in the book of Zechariah. But the themes of Daniel reach their culmination in God's revelation to the apostle John in the book of Revelation. And note, it's not the revelation of the apostle John, it's the revelation of Jesus Christ, if you really stop and think about it. Understanding the prophecies of Daniel is necessary to the understanding of the book of Revelation. Daniel chapter 1 was through chapter 6. The first six chapters of Daniel are mainly historical books. All of them, of course, except the experiences of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace, have to do with Daniel and his relationship with the kings of Babylon and Medo-Persia. We find that there's not only historical material there, and these things are things that historically happened, but along with that historical material, God also includes prophetic information. Daniel 2 is not only historic, but is also prophetic. Nebuchadnezzar's dream and Daniel's interpretation of it referred to future events that were far beyond the scope of human understanding. In his dream, Nebuchadnezzar saw the image of a man representing four successive world empires. The head of gold represented Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian Empire. Nebuchadnezzar was an absolute ruler. The arms and the breast of silver represented Persia. Persia had a limited monarchy instead. The thighs of brass represented Greece, which was weaker than the preceding governments because it split into four different parts after the death of Alexander the Great. The legs and the feet of iron represented Rome, which lasted longer but was weaker than the others because it was divided into the Eastern and the Western Empire. Hence, you have two legs. The feet of clay mingled with iron point toward the time of the end when the Roman Empire will have the least amount of strength and will be swept away by the return of Jesus Christ. There's a progressive weakening of the Roman Empire demonstrated by the mixture of the clay and the iron. The development, obviously the development of these four great world empires has been confirmed by history. More significantly, no other conquerors, Muhammad, Charlemagne, Napoleon, the Kaiser, or Hitler, has succeeded in establishing a world empire. The world is still waiting for the kingdom that shall never be destroyed, and the stone cut out of the mountain without hands, that shall destroy all empires, destroying the rebellious nations in pieces like a potter's vessel. This passage builds upon that which has been revealed to Isaiah about the kingdom of the Messiah. According to the Septuagint, the events that happened to Daniel in Daniel chapter 3 were in the 18th year of King Nebuchadnezzar. And it's about 20 years, of course, after Daniel and his friends had been carried captive to Babylon, somewhere very near to the time of the destruction of Jerusalem. In Daniel chapter 3, God works in the hearts of Daniel's three friends, so they have a determination to be true to God no matter what the cost. God goes with them into the fire, not only to honor their faith, but to demonstrate to the dignitaries that are gathered there the power of the God of Jerusalem over the boasted gods of the Babylonians. For the second time, God manifests himself in the palace of the mighty empire, and for the second time, Nebuchadnezzar acknowledges God to be the true God to the bounds of his empire. And so even while God's people were taken off the earth in the sense of having them be a testimony to the rest of the nations, Daniel was a testimony to the nations, and the Jews were still a testimony to the nations, and God, of course, had promised that they would be coming back. The fourth chapter of Daniel also contains prophecy with the fulfillment of Daniel's interpretation of the king's dream taking place a year later. This proud king, boasting of his accomplishments in Babylon the Great. This is Babylon the Great, which I have built. Suddenly becomes insane. He's incapacitated for 7 years out of his 45-year reign. Daniel's interpretation of his dream brought him public attention, and he was elevated to the position of prime minister. Daniel was elevated to the position of prime minister, placing him over political and educational authority. It had to be tough for the Chaldeans to accept this Jewish kid who was able to make interpretations of dreams, who was able to become the prime minister of a nation. That was something they should have been able to do. And so I think that Daniel was really resented by many people. By the time we get to Daniel chapter 4, Daniel had been in Babylon for 70 years already and was a very old man. Daniel had lost his role under King Belshazzar, who was the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. His father, Nabonidus, nice name, huh? Nabonidus, N-A-B-O-N-I-D-U-S. His father, Nabonidus, was at war with Cyrus, and while Belshazzar was reigning in Babylon. Interesting development, because the Hebrew language calls Nebuchadnezzar the father of Belshazzar, because the Hebrew language has no word to differentiate between father and grandfather. Jeremiah chapter 27, verse 7 makes this clear. And all nations shall serve him and his son's son until the very end of his land come. And then many nations and great kings shall serve themselves of him. But they call him his son and his son's son. And you'll find that down through the scripture. There is no word for grandfather. I'm glad we have a word for that in the English language. It's great. But you know what? It's very humbling to see your children's children. It's a very humbling thing. And it makes you feel very insignificant. Not to the child, but... Until 1853, there was no mention of Belshazzar in any historical records. The liberal critics, of course, gloated over this because this was evidence to them that the book of Daniel was not historical. Nothing they wanted more than to be able to prove Daniel was not historical. But in 1853, an inscription was found on a cornerstone of a temple built by Nabonidus. It was in Ur. It read this. It said this. May I, Nabonidus, king of Babylon, not sin against thee, and may reverence for thee dwell in the heart of Belshazzar, my firstborn favorite son. Well, it's pretty obvious now who Belshazzar is, and that Belshazzar was the son of Nabonidus. At Belshazzar's feast, when the handwriting on the wall appeared, the queen mother remembered Daniel's interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dreams. Daniel was summoned. Daniel rebuked the king for his impiety and his pride. You know, he was drinking out of the glasses from the temple. He rebuked him for his impiety and his pride, and he reminded him how Nebuchadnezzar had been humbled by God. His interpretation of the handwriting was that Belshazzar would be slain that very night because of his idolatry, that the city would be taken, and that the Medo-Persian Empire would be established. We look at the Medo-Persian Empire now. Cyrus overthrew the city of Babylon by diverting the Euphrates River into a new channel. He was guided by deserters from the city of Babylon, from the armies of Babylon, marched through the dry riverbed into Babylon while the feast to their gods was going on. No doubt this is the feast that Daniel was talking about in the book of Daniel as well. It's not known if Darius was the father-in-law of Cyrus or if he was one of his generals, but it is believed that Darius did lead the army which captured Babylon. While Cyrus led his armies on the northern and western wars, Darius ruled in Babylon for about 2 years until the arrival of Cyrus. Under Darius the Mede, there were about 120 princes. There were 120 princes which ruled over the empire, with three presidents ruling over them. Because Daniel was the first president under the king, jealousy developed, and a plot was arranged to cause Daniel to be removed. As a kid, one of my favorite Bible story books was the Bible story about Daniel and the lion's den, and about Darius coming to the lion's den in the morning, saying, "Is thy God, O Daniel, able to save thee?" And of course, Daniel's God was. The plot was that whosoever would pray to anyone other than the king would be thrown into a den of lions. But this whole plot failed when the angels of God closed the lions' mouths. When the lions' mouths were closed by the angel of God. Daniel was as faithful to God in his old age as he was when he was a youth. His enemies hated him because of his faithfulness to God and his resulting determined opposition to corruption in government. Corruption in government was pretty commonplace in those societies, just as it seems to be pretty commonplace in our society. I think about corruption in government, and our governor has pledged to balance the budget without raising taxes. And so to do so, he sold bonds this year. It was his friends who sold the bonds and made millions of dollars off of them. They're going to sell the Thompson Center. They're going to sell the Tollway Authority building. The brokers who sell those buildings are going to make big bucks off the sale of those buildings. And then those same brokers will lease the buildings back to the state and make money off of that. Now, is there corruption? Sure, but it's legal corruption. And so we find the same thing happened today with politics today. Daniel's enemies hated him because of his faithfulness to God. One preacher once said that the reason the lions didn't attack Daniel was because he was two-thirds grit and the other third gristle. Now, we know that that's not the case, but it's an interesting observation about Daniel and who he was. Under Cyrus, the Persian, in 536 B.C., Daniel continued in his high office. Cyrus had a policy of restoring displaced people to their homelands. So it was that in 538 B.C., Cyrus issued a decree to permit the Jews to return to Jerusalem. We're told in Daniel chapter 6, verse 28, so this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Undoubtedly, Daniel was one of Cyrus's counselors, responsible for sending the Jews back to Jerusalem with their sacred treasure. As we go on in the book of Daniel now, we get to the section that is considered to be the prophetic section of the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 6 through 12 makes up the prophetic section of Daniel. Daniel's four visions show the relationship of the nations to the Jewish people, including a definite description of the time of the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. As we look at Daniel's visions in chapter 7 and 8, the visions of Daniel occurred during these years of out of office during the reign of Belshazzar. They cover the same material as in Nebuchadnezzar's dream in Daniel chapter 2, but they can include more detail. For example, in the vision in Daniel chapter 7, Babylon is pictured by a lion. Medo-Persia is pictured as a bear. Greece by a leopard. And Rome by a nameless, terrible beast. In Daniel chapter 8, Medo-Persia appears as a ram, while Greece appears as a he-goat with a notable horn, which represented Alexander the Great. Daniel's vision included one like the Son of Man and the Ancient of Days, pointing to the Messiah receiving his earthly kingdom from God himself. The king of fierce countenance that Daniel talks about is widely recognized as Antiochus Epiphanes, who tried to stamp out Jewish religion. Along with the near view of Antiochus, there also seems to be a distant background view of a much more ominous destroyer that's going to mar the closing days of histories. Antiochus was only a symbolic forerunner of this destroyer who is yet to come. We look now at the prophecy, Daniel's prophecy of the 70 weeks. Chapter 9 of Daniel begins with Daniel's intercession for his people. It teaches us much about prayer. And this prayer comes as Daniel understands the writings of Jeremiah near the conclusion of the exile. Daniel understood that it was going to be 70 years. And so Daniel's prayer for his people includes confession and intercession for the knowledge of the future of his people. He's just begging God and saying, Lord, show me what's going to happen to the Jewish people. Show us what's going to happen for the future of our nation. And God rewarded his prayer by giving Daniel a revelation of Israel's future from the time of the decree of Cyrus unto the end of the present age. The angel Gabriel reveals to Daniel that 70 weeks were determined upon his people and the holy city. Now, when you look up on his people and the holy city, it's talking about the Jews and the city of Jerusalem. To finish transgressions, to make an end of sins. You notice that all of those things haven't happened. We haven't had an end of sins yet, have we? To make reconciliation for iniquity. Now, that's been done. To bring in everlasting righteousness, that's not been done, and to seal up the vision and prophecy and to anoint the most holy. And so there are some things that are left in this list of things that Daniel has that are not yet finished, that are coming in the future. The everlasting sealing up, the everlasting righteousness, the sealing up of vision and prophecy, the anointing of the Most Holy, obviously haven't taken place yet. The term 70 weeks is generally understood to mean 70 weeks of years. The word week used here is the very same word used of Jacob when he worked a week for Rachel, which was, of course, a period of 7 years. And so the total period of time in the 70 weeks here is 490 years. These weeks of sevens are divided into three time periods. First, you have the 7 weeks, or the 49 years, that saw the restoration of Jerusalem, as recorded in Ezra and Nehemiah. Second, you have an additional 62 weeks, which is another 434 years to be completed until Messiah the Prince should be, get this, cut off. We're talking here about the death of Jesus Christ. And third, you have the 1 week, or the 7 years, which is the period of tribulation just preceding the second coming of Christ, when Israel shall again be in her own land. There's a book that's been written called The Coming Prince. The book The Coming Prince is about this 490-year period that God is going to cover the history of the Jews. And he demonstrates from the day the decree was given to go forth, to go and rebuild Jerusalem, until Messiah the Prince was cut off, was 483 years. That leaves your final 7 years for God to deal with the nation of Israel in the tribulation. Because once again, the church is going to be taken off the earth, and things are going to be as they were in the past, where there was no church. And God will be dealing with the nation of Israel as his people to represent him upon the earth. Jesus made reference to Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, and the abomination of desolations. Again, in Matthew chapter 24, verse 15. When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. Obviously, this has not happened. The abomination of desolation is something that will yet happen. Stand in the holy place. Whosoever readeth, let him understand. Now, what was the context of this? The context was, his disciples came to Jesus in Matthew chapter 24, verse 3, and they said, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, tell us, when shall be these things be, and what shall be the sign of thy coming and the end of the world? So we're not just dealing with something that's going to happen shortly. We're dealing with something that's going to happen in the end times. And Jesus speaks of the abomination of desolations that way. And so obviously the fulfillment of the abomination of desolations has not yet been completed, but will be completed as a sign of Christ's coming and the end of the world. We look now at Israel's future. The key to understanding the last three chapters of Daniel lies in Daniel chapter 10, verse 14. Now I am come to make thee understand what shall befall thy people in the latter days. For yet the vision is for many days. This message came after 3 weeks of intensive fasting and prayer. The messenger that God was sending in answer to Daniel's prayer had been resisted for these 3 weeks by the prince of the kingdom of Persia. God lifts the veil from the unseen world and shows Daniel the spiritual battle that goes on when saints pray. These unseen angels are interested in the future of Israel. In the book of Revelation, we find that the angels in the first part there are interested in the church. In Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12, the powers of the unseen world are the chief enemies against which Christians have to fight. We're not fighting against people. We're not fighting against the flesh and blood, but against principalities and spiritual powers and spiritual wickedness in high places. The primary concern, of course, here in Daniel, these chapters in Daniel, is how the Gentile nations are going to affect Palestine and the Jewish people. The first part of Daniel here deals with the kings who were to rule the restored remnant in Jerusalem. There are references to Xerxes and to Alexander, but this really centers on the divisions of Alexander's empire into the four different parts. Because Palestine was centered between Egypt and Syria were two different parts of the former Greek empire. The wars of these nations are described in detail. The deeds of Antiochus Epiphanes, the Syrian, are described in Daniel chapter 11. The last portion of the chapter in Daniel chapter 11 points to his anti-type, which is the Antichrist of the last days. Daniel chapter 12 predicts the last days or the 70th week of Daniel and is characterized as a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation even to that same time. Daniel's instructed to shut up the words, to seal the book, even to the time of the end. He goes on to give a characteristic of those last days when he adds, many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. It's pretty obvious that many run to and fro nowadays, isn't it? Last year when I traveled to India, Tim and I were traveling, and one of the things that just really struck us, you know, for a lot of people on that plane, it was very, very commonplace to have international travel. It wasn't for me, and it was more so for Tim because he did that for a long time for his job. But it's true today. We have the global community, we have the frequent travel from nation to nation with the frequent traveler miles that you can get. There's also been an incredible explosion of knowledge during the last 100 years. My grandfather grew up with a horse and buggy. My father remembers them getting their first car and remembered them getting their first tractor. And so we've had a tremendous explosion of knowledge, of technology, and of course a lot of it escalates even through the use of computers. Daniel didn't understand everything that he wrote. The Jewish people didn't understand most of what he wrote. What the Jewish people did understand is that God promised to spare them as a nation. Daniel's unfulfilled prophecies come to light to us today through the book of Revelation, which describes many of Daniel's prophecies. The church age, from the Jewish rejection of Christ to the beginning of Israel's 70th week, is never seen in the book of Daniel. The two parts of the prophecy are given in such a way that there appears to be no passage of time between them. In the end times, we can read Daniel's prophecies with much more understanding. Although Daniel mentions the resurrection of the dead, he's given no details on how this is going to happen. When we compare the lives of Joseph and Daniel, there are parallels. Both were elevated from virtually being slaves to the level of second in the kingdom. This is clear evidence. It is God who is in absolute control of the affairs of men and nations. God can use his children, even when they're captives, to direct the administration of kingdoms. In conclusion, I just want to read these verses from Daniel chapter 2, verses 20 to 22, because these are words that are pertinent and that we need to remember. Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. He changeth the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding. He revealeth the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in the darkness, and the light dwelleth with him." Thank you. That completes this lecture. We go on to the next lecture in Hosea, Joel, and Amos. Daniel chapter 2, verses 20 to 22. Any other questions?